This program is brought to you by PersonalLifeMedia.com. Hi, and welcome to Dishy Mix. This is your host, Susan Bratton, and thanks so much for tuning into the show today. On this episode, we have David Cowan. He's the managing partner of Bessemer Ventures. I met David standing in a cattle line at the TED conference and was just unbelievably impressed with his brain power and the magnitude of his personality. And that's what it takes to get on to Dishy Mix for an interview. So you're going to get to meet David today. He's a born-again atheist. We're going to talk a little bit about his love of Kurt Vonnegut. He's a grammar nerd, and we have that in common. We're going to talk about timebanks.org. We're going to talk about donuts, and maybe we'll get Bart Simpson on the line. Or Homer. It's Homer who loves donuts. We're going to talk about book collecting and critical thinking. We're going to talk about the man sack and his grapefruit addiction.
If you would like to buy the sweater that Gabrielle Solis was wearing on Desperate Housewives,
right?
Or if you'd like to maybe buy the furniture in her home,
yeah.
Or if you'd like to test drive her car, or if you'd like to get last season's DVD set for Desperate Housewives, then when you go to the Desperate Housewives site, you'll see that there's an area for shopping for merchandise related to the show. And so delivery agent, they keep track of everything that appears on the screen. But as I thought about it, I realized that there's a very important reason why I don't. And that is that I think that it's really difficult to raise a critical thinking child when at the same time we are teaching them to value faith. I mean, faith is nothing more than belief in that for which there is no material evidence. We've crafted what we call advisements. They're not commandments. They're advisements, and you can find them at advisements.blogspot.com. And one thing that's important about them, because they don't have the authority of God behind them with a threat of heaven and hell as reward and punishment, they have to be compelling.
Proclamation number 2, donuts.
Chocolate iced with sprinkles are the best donuts.
Is it a merce or a man sack?
It is not a merce. It is not a man sack. It is a purse. That is what I carry. There's no getting around it.
Welcome, David.
Hi, Susan.
Hey, it's great to have you. Thank you so much for giving us the time today.
Of course. Of course. It's a lot more comfortable today than it was when we were pressed up against each other
exactly.
Over at TED.
It was our sweaty first meeting, right? Well, let's see. For our listeners who might not know you, David, you're the managing partner at Bessemer Ventures, and you've been there since 92, so about 15 years. You've made 45 early-stage investments, including 19 that have gone public and 17 that have been acquired by public companies. That's put you in the Forbes Midas list. The Forbes Midas list ranks you among the world's top 10 venture investors, and actually, you're number 6. You're beating out people like Michael Moritz, for example, from Sequoia, or Frank Quattroni. That's an amazing attribute. And I want to know how getting on the Forbes Midas list changed your life.
Oh, boy. Well, I think I'm afraid to say it didn't really change my life. And as an investor, there are some years where I have good years and some years where I have bad years. And I think you're referring to one of the particularly good years, and there certainly are other years when things aren't always going so well. And in fact, some of the other investors that you've mentioned have since gone on to really be involved in some great startups that I wish I were a part of, but wasn't. And so I think if nothing else, it's just a reminder that there's a lot of luck in venture capital. There's a lot of luck in a lot of aspects of life, but certainly in venture capital. And, you know, I try not to confuse luck for anything else.
So you must have more than luck. It can't all be luck. You're an unbelievably smart guy, and you've made more than your fair share of great guesses. You must have something that happens to you, a little tickle in your stomach or a level of excitement or something that tells you when you see a deal that it might be the one. What is that?
Well, I guess I do get that tickle, and I get it a lot. But I'd say the real secret of my success, other than just being lucky, is having really smart partners who stop me from pursuing my gut feel every time I get that little tickle. I got into the business because I really love computer science and technology. I came to it with a passion for the products of the industry, not necessarily the business side of it. And, I just get a kick out of almost every business plan I get to hear about. It's just very exciting to meet with entrepreneurs every day and hear about their plans. And I get excited about almost all of them.
How much time do you spend on a weekly basis hearing pitches and meeting with entrepreneurs?
I probably spend about an hour or two every day, which is less than I'd like to. But over the years, I have accumulated responsibilities to my partners and also to the companies I've invested in. So I wish I could spend even more, but I do get to spend an hour to two a day listening to new ideas.
So you're currently on the board of Netly, Next Medium, Nominum, Vimo, Flock, Determina, and LifeLock. Those are some great names, by the way. I love them. I know Next Medium. I know Hame Watt. And, the listeners of Dishy Mix are primarily people in the internet, Web 2.0, media, marketing, advertising, publishing, kind of that world. Of all the boards that you sit on, which ones do you think are the most interesting that you could talk about with regard to my audience?
Well, certainly Next Medium is a promising company. It's still very early in the development of brand integration as an advertising medium. It's happened quite a bit opportunistically at a high level between advertisers and media properties. As you can see, with what Burger King did with The Apprentice or what BMW did with James Bond films. And it also happens every single day at a very low level in the way that companies get their products onto the sets of television and movies so that the production companies don't have to go out and buy those products. But what Next Medium sees is an opportunity to really take all of those opportunities where products appear on the TV screen or in a movie and create an advertising opportunity out of that, what they call a brand integration. And it's still very early in the development of that industry, but I think that everyone, both on the advertiser side and on the production side, is excited about it because they see that the 30-second spot commercial is not as viable as it used to be in a new world where technology allows content to be consumed in a nonlinear way.
Absolutely. And when you can give your product to someone and get it in a movie, what's better than that, right? And so what Next Medium does is essentially track that and track the number of impressions. And I've heard even that as an example, say that someone's holding a can of Coke in a movie. If the label is facing out, it's worth more than if you can just kind of tell it's a can of Coke. And the Next Medium actually tracks the impression levels and gives a quality grading. I guess I'm sure you have a real word for that, but a quality grading to the actual integration. Is that true?
Right. In order for any advertising medium to really take off and be scalable, you have to be able to measure the effectiveness of the advertisement. And so that really requires a lot of metadata about the campaign. And that's what Next Medium is bringing. Next Medium is one of many companies that we've invested in behind this convergence of the internet and video entertainment.
What other ones?
Well, another company is GoTV, which is the largest producer of mobile video. So they create news shows and hip-hop shows and all different kinds of entertainment for consumption on cell phones. We're investors in Rever, which is a video advertising video network. We're investors in Delivery Agent. Delivery Agent runs CNN.com and also drives the e-commerce for most of the networks and television that you see.
I don't understand what that is. What does delivery agent do? I've heard of them a couple of times. I think I've even had them speak at AdTech, but I can't remember, and I don't quite understand it.
So if you would like to buy the sweater that Gabrielle Solis was wearing on Desperate Housewives,
right?
Or if you'd like to maybe buy the furniture in her home,
yeah.
Or if you'd like to test drive her car, or if you'd like to get last season's DVD set for Desperate Housewives, then when you go to the Desperate Housewives site, you'll see that there's an area for shopping for merchandise related to the show. And so delivery agent, they keep track of everything that appears on the screen. They've got, you know, I would guess at this point that they have maybe 90% of primetime television cataloged, if you will. And so you can really go and shop everything that you see on television or in the movies.
So the sticking point is the consumer behavior, creating the consumer behavior to let them know that that's actually available to them, right?
That's right. And so we do that primarily on the websites of the networks who run those shows, or on the official sites of the shows themselves.
Okay.
But increasingly, people are consuming the video on their computers or on computing platforms, and when that happens, we can more easily integrate the shopping experience into the viewing of the program.
So, delivery agent's going to do a deal with Juiced?
We may. We are certainly looking forward to the migration of video to computing platforms, because it will make it even easier to make that connection between viewing the program and buying the merchandise.
Exactly. And then just tie it all into eBay, too, while you're at it. Well, let's see. I want to switch gears a little bit, because the day that I met you, we were talking about God and atheism. Now, you're married apparently to a French girl, and I want to come back and hear about what it's like to be married to a beautiful French woman. And you're a father of three, and you conducted a class at the TED event about raising children without God. Was that the title of it?
That's it.
So why would you want to do that? Tell us the story.
As fatherhood loomed for me, and I was thinking about what was important for me to teach my children, I came to think that the answer to that question was too important to simply go with the default answers of, I will teach my children whatever I was taught, or whatever other people teach their children. I think that I really wanted to think about how to prepare them for the world so that they would be healthy, happy, and smart, just like we all want for our children. And as I did that, it really forced me to think critically about values and about how I think about the world. As I did that, I felt a responsibility to really try to be honest with my children, and first that required me to be honest with myself. And so as I did that, I had to struggle with some very uncomfortable realizations, which is that I don't believe in God. And this really started with university, when I learned about the history of different religions, and I saw how all the religions, how one borrowed from another, and the mythology of one religion is rooted in the mythology of another. And I realized that the religion that I come from was just one tribe among many, and you know, our mythology was some derivation of the mythology of the Phoenicians and the Sumerians and the Mesopotamians before us. And that really brought home for me the importance of opening my mind to the idea that maybe it is just mythology. And I started to ask myself, why would I want to pass that on to my children? And there are some reasons why people do want to pass that on to their children. But as I thought about it, I realized that there's a very important reason why I don't. And that is that I think that it's really difficult to raise a critical thinking child when at the same time we are teaching them to value faith. I mean, faith is nothing more than belief in that for which there is no material evidence. At least that's what it says in the dictionary. And I want to teach my children to form beliefs based upon evidence. I think that's what is driving a lot of progress in our world. We are all the beneficiaries of science and medicine and technology. And I think that there are a lot of problems in the world that many of them stem from the faith that people put in ideas for which there is no evidence at all. And so I've found that it's been great raising my children in a way that I think is honest, and they really are critical thinkers, and they really, you know, and it helps them in all kinds of ways. And so that's something that I wanted to share with the people at the conference. I was really surprised, by the way, that it was much better attended than I would have expected.
Yeah, I couldn't even get in.
And I'm still in touch with people who have contacted me afterwards, expressing gratitude for challenging them. And I did not experience what I expected would be a very negative backlash. And I think I found that, in fact, there are probably a lot more atheists in the world than people realize. People just don't like to talk about it because there's somewhat of a stigma associated with it.
Right, exactly. The word atheist is a very charged word. But if you were to discuss it in terms of theology and critical thinking and an embracing of religious concepts and comparative religion, and those seem to be much better much better terminology for having a discussion around the belief of God and the way we raise our children. We're going to have to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of other things. This is your host, Susan Bratton, and you're listening to David Cowan, the managing partner of Bessemer Ventures. We're going to thank our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Listen to Living Green, Effortless Ecology for Everyday People, a weekly online audio program featuring champions of sustainable living at personallifemedia.com.
We're back, and this is your host, Susan Bratton. I have David Cowan, the managing partner of Bessemer Ventures. I met David at TED, and at the break, we were talking about raising our children without God and what that means. I want to pick that up a little bit more, David, because I think it's an important discussion. You have a lot of resources for people to consider on your blog. You know, I didn't write down the blog URL for that one, but I know you can get to it through whohastimeforthis.blogspot.com, which is a great name for a blog, by the way. One of the things that you mentioned in that was Richard Dawkins' letter to his 10-year-old daughter. Can you tell our listeners about that? Because I think that might be something that would get people to actually click through and read your blog about being a born-again atheist.
So Richard Dawkins says it much more eloquently than I can, but he writes a letter to his 10-year-old daughter and really tries to explain to her the benefits of why she really wants to think critically about the world. And I'd encourage you to look at the letter. It's easy to find on the web, and it's also easy to find on the Richard Dawkins website, which is actually a great resource for all things atheist, if you will. And Dawkins has really, I mean, he's actually, I think, launched quite a wave of critical thinking in the world. His book, The God Delusion, has been on the bestseller charts. And it was followed by Sam Harris's The End of Faith and Chris Hitchens' book, God is Not Great, which have also become bestsellers. And so thanks to Richard Dawkins, who's an Oxford professor and I'm honored to say now a friend of mine, but thanks to him and to Mr. Hitchens and Mr. Harris and other authors like Michael Shermer, the questions that he's raised have really become part of mainstream dialogue. And I think at a time when, at least in the United States, people have become very disillusioned with a government that has acted on faith, a government that has taken very, very important steps without having material evidence for its actions, I think people are really coming to question whether faith and gut feel are the basis upon which we should live our lives.
I want to throw another book into that book list since we're on it. I like Daniel Dennett's book, Breaking the Spell, because he's a Darwinian theorist, and he really calls for just having us carefully study the benefits of religion in our culture so that we can understand the value that it brings and the things that it doesn't do well enough. Have you read that book?
So I've read parts of Breaking the Spell. I certainly should have mentioned it because it's also an important book mm-hmm. in that genre. And I do think that there are very positive things that religion can bring into a household, but there are alternatives. We don't need religion to teach ethics to our children. In fact, I think within the religions that I've been exposed to, if you really want to teach your children to be good, you have to pick and choose from among the precepts within those religions. And why pick and choose when instead we can just think for ourselves and develop our own basic ideas around some simple concepts like treat other people the way you'd like to be treated yourself, and you know, take care of yourself And
it doesn't need to be a commandment to be a, to be information.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a community of people I'm involved with where, in fact, we've crafted what we call advisements. They're not commandments. They're advisements, and you can find them at advisements.blogspot.com. And one thing that's important about them, because they don't have the authority of God behind them with a threat of heaven and hell as reward and punishment, they have to be compelling. And when you read an advisement, if it's going to work, it has to be something that you would think is actually, there are good reasons why you'd want to live that way. And they have to be principles that would work for everybody. They're universal. For example, you know, it's not universal to think of yourself as the chosen people. Well, what about the other people?
Right.
Well, how should they think of themselves?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that Dennett brings up some good points about the value of religion. I think there are ways that we can bring culture and ethics and community into our homes without the baggage of theology.
I want to say one last thing on that. I wonder, and I doubt you have the answer. This is really just a theoretical question, but I wonder if we added up Dawkins and Sherman and Harris and Hitchens and all of those books and the number of units sold versus a purpose-driven life, I wonder what the ratio would be. You don't have any idea, do you?
Oh, it's just a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, right. Millions and millions of copies of A Purpose-Driven Life and probably tens of thousands of the other list.
But you know, one thing about a scientific viewpoint, mm-hmm, is that it sticks, because once people think about the common sense approach of the scientific method,
mm-hmm,
it's hard to go back.
Yes.
And so progress may be slow, but it's progress.
Great. That's a very uplifting perspective. Thank you. I want to just finish off on this whole concept of teaching our children critical thinking. You reference a book on advisements.blogspot.com, Why People Believe Weird Things. I haven't read that. Can you just give us the like 2-sentence highlight of what that book's about? Is that a good one?
Oh, that's terrific. And it really got me started on my journey to be a critical thinker. And what it talks about is, how is it that people come to believe things that we might consider to be obviously not true? Now, we all have different ideas of what that is, and yet we know there are people out there who, many, many people who pay psychics and astrologers and buy medical remedies that are obviously scams, who believe that they've been abducted by UFOs, and who, you know, I believe, subscribe to religious mythologies that are so far-fetched that it's incredible to me that those beliefs are as strong as they are. How is it that people are so often wrong? And one thing that Mr. Shermer does in this book is he really talks about how our brains evolved to be pattern recognizers, how our brains evolved in a way that worked really, really well when we were evolving and we were living in the wild. However, those pattern recognition approaches don't serve us quite as well when we're trying to process really complex observations about the universe around us and how it really leads us to make mistakes because of things like selective memory bias or not recognizing randomness. That's a concept that's been really eloquently illustrated in the book Fooled by Randomness. So there, he talks about all of these little mistakes that we can make along the way, and it's a great read because not only does it make you understand why other people may subscribe to problematic ideas, but it also gives you some warning signs as to when it is that you, in fact, are subscribing to something that is not really a logical conclusion from the evidence.
When you're succumbing to your own biology, huh?
Exactly right. And for me, that was a first step for me to really think about, how am I making the mistakes that he talks about in that book?
I like it. That's great. Self-recognition is the first step. Let's play a game.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I love games.
Ah, good. All right. This one's called Proclamation, and I just made it up. I'm going to say a word or a couple of words, and you're going to make a proclamation. Are you ready?
I think so.
This is torturous, isn't it? I am ready.
That's my first part.
I love it. All right. Proclamation. Are you ready? Grammar.
Grammar has been greatly neglected, which is probably not a bad thing.
You can give us a little color on that proclamation. Go ahead.
The English language is obviously complicated, and it's also evolving. And there are rules that underline the construction of our sentences, and unfortunately those rules do change over time. So it's quite normal that we would not be able to always follow all of the rules that are currently considered authoritative as we speak. People make grammatical mistakes. That's perfectly normal. I think you mentioned grammar because I wrote a blog post once complaining about grammar, and I wasn't complaining that people don't speak grammatically, because I don't think that's such a crime, and in fact, it's even hard to say what is grammatical. But I do have to say that I have a pet peeve.
I knew it. Here it is.
Which is hypercorrection.
Okay, what's that mean?
Hypercorrection is the practice of making a big display of correct grammar when, in fact, one is actually speaking incorrectly.
With whom will we go to the movies?
Well, with whom will we go to the movies is actually correct.
But it's a display.
Well, that's a display.
Yeah.
So I don't mind displays of correct grammar.
Okay.
I also don't mind incorrect grammar. It's the displays of incorrect grammar. It's when people are trying to make a big point about being grammatically correct and they're not.
So I got it.
So an example might be, let's call whomever is going to the movies with us.
Aha, uh-huh, perfect. Thank you.
Well, it would actually it's grammatically correct to say, let's call whoever is going to the movies with us.
Yeah.
Or another one is, when can you come by to meet with Mary and I?
Yeah, instead of me, right.
And that's actually probably the most common.
Very common.
Type of hypercorrection is people use I instead of me.
Yeah.
People seem to think that anytime two people are mentioned in a sentence, that if the second one
yourself
is me, that it should somehow be changed to I.
Exactly. Hey, I'm going to switch now for proclamation number two. We're taking you from highbrow to lowbrow. Proclamation number two, donuts.
Chocolate iced with sprinkles are the best donuts.
Now, do you have somewhat of a donut? Are you a donut connoisseur? You've spoken about donuts before.
I am not. I'm a sucker for a good donut.
Mm-hmm.
They remind me of my childhood, the best times, and they are yummy and scrumptious.
Mm-hmm.
And the times that I really enjoy donuts are when I'm in a meeting at a business and business is going well, and you know I can just sit back and enjoy the donuts.
I love a good donut too, and I don't think there are enough donut shops in the world. And my favorite is a plain cake. And I love the Asian donut shops we have in California because they really make beautiful donuts. I hate the Krispy Kreme Fako Fakos, and I love the real live Korean or Vietnamese donut shops. How about you?
Please stop.
Why? Because you need a donut?
Yeah, you're getting me hungry.
You're getting me so excited. Okay, last proclamation. Is it a merce or a mansack?
It is not a merce. It is not a mansack. It is a purse. That is what I carry. There's no getting around it. Now, it doesn't have flowers on it, or it is an old camera case, but I find it's the most practical way to carry all my things with me and not lose them and leave them behind.
I love a man who carries a purse. My husband is a purse-carrying stud, and I buy him multiple purses over the years because, you know, he has different fashion looks and all kinds of things. And the latest one we have, I think, is a Timbuktu. Timbuktu now has really nice purse. You call it a purse. We call it a mansack or a merce when we're being silly. But I think men should really consider this with the keys and the Blackberries. There's a lot of stuff to carry. The sunglasses. There's a lot of stuff to carry around now, don't you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the also the lipstick and the compact, too.
Well, I actually think it's unbelievably sexy when a man carries a whatever you want to call it. I call it a merce, because that's a confident man right there. That is the sure sign of a man who's fully into his masculinity. And, of course, what's better than a masculine man, right?
Then, well, that says to me maybe I should ditch the camera case and really start going for the more fashionable look, the one that matches my shoes.
Maybe. You don't have to go that far. It's okay to be unmatched. That's still masculine. I want to just close off on two things. The first one is Kurt Vonnegut, who recently passed away, and you're a Vonnegut lover. I want you to explain to people who maybe haven't read Vonnegut. I grew up, I read all his books in the 70s, but then kind of lost him over the last years of his life. Remind people about the beauty of his work.
Let me reference one book, The Sirens of Titan.
Mm-hmm. I never read that one.
So in this one book, It's a fun story with lots of interesting characters. At one point in the book, it becomes clear that the entire history of our species was really just a step in someone's plan to deliver a replacement part to a space traveler who was deserted on Titan, a moon of Saturn. And for me, it was just a wonderful way to think about how complex systems can produce these emergent properties. In this case, we need to get a replacement part to this moon on Titan, and so let's somehow seed some life on this rock that's the third planet from the sun. And at some point, as intelligent life develops, they will naturally reach out and explore the planets around them and bring us this part that we need.
Nice.
Because I think that, you know, a lot of the beauty that we get in science and economics and social political theory and a lot of other disciplines, a lot of that beauty comes from the emergent properties that we see from simple, complex systems.
Well, like biomimicry, which is really gaining such a foothold now. Very similar, right?
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, it's the idea that you would create products or solve problems by looking into nature and using the beauty and the functionality inherent in biology and nature to think up new products, as an example.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Timebanks.org. We're going to close with that. And I thought that was an interesting concept. I'd never heard about it till I read one of your blogs. And so I was hoping you could just share that with our listeners as a really kind of a nice way. I always like to end with an aspirational up note on my show. So, of course, everyone comes back next week. So maybe we could talk about timebanks.org.
Of course. Timebanks.org is an organization that helps communities develop time banks. And time banks are a center, if you will, in a community where people can help each other. And the idea is that there's someone in the community who perhaps needs some medicine from the drugstore, and I'm going to go deliver it. I'm going to go bring that person her medicine. Or I'm going to help somebody with some shopping, or I'm going to help somebody move. And as you contribute to the time bank, you develop deposits. And the community then, and you can withdraw those deposits from the community. And it's a fun way to develop this a community where people, you know, help each other. And I just think it's such a better way for people to come together, you know, than to convene on Sunday and sing songs to mythological deities. A lot of people think, well, it's really important to go to church or synagogue because we have this community and these people and people can help each other. And I think timebanks.org presents a way for us to help each other without having to also engage in the religious parts as well. And I know that it's been very successful. There are a lot of people who have been helped and who have gotten a lot out of contributing to time banks. And it's something that's pretty easy for people to start within their communities if they're interested to.
It's a great way to reconnect with community, especially if church isn't your thing, but you want to give back or you need help and you don't know where to go to get it. I love the concept of bringing community together. And I love the web enabling that. It's kind of another version to me of Yahoo Answers or Spire or LinkedIn's Answers or, you know, the way we're going now, which is to reach out through the ether and ask for help where you need it. I like that this takes a physical manifestation of assistance, and that's even better to me.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of success in the Yahoo Answers mode. We've seen a lot of success now at Wikia, which is the company that we started with Jimmy Wales and the Wikipedia team to build communities around areas of knowledge, specifically ones outside of the scope of an encyclopedia. The web is just obviously a terrific platform for bringing people together.
Well, today, DishyBix has been a terrific platform for bringing people together. Those people are you and me, and it's been fun. I'm so impressed with you. It's been a delight to have some time to hear your thoughts, which are unique and special and well-considered. So thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Susan.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. So you've been listening to David Cowan. He's the managing partner at Bessemer Ventures, and I am your host, Susan Bratton. I hope you'll tune in next week, and thank you so much for giving us your time today. Have a great day.
Find more great shows like this on personallifemedia.com.